let me just say, we've done these events in partnership with Conservative Home since, I think, 2016 now, and I don't say this very often, they are a pleasure to work with, and we look forward to this event every year. I think, in case George Osborne gets offended, the difference between Lee and him is that Osborne held the jobs at the same time, whereas... which leader... You're not still a minor, are you? No. All right. I'm not going to introduce you because everyone knows who you are, but you've spent a bit of time at this conference talking about history, talking about Margaret Thatcher, talking about your... what, if this was the X Factor, we'd call your journey. Just thinking back to the 70s and 80s, what did she do wrong in terms of communities like yours? I mean, looking back now, was it wrong to close the pits or was it wrong to leave those communities afterwards? What would you have done differently?
Well, before I start, Anand, I just want to go back to the award that I won.
Oh, okay.
I want to just remind you that I got the Conholme Backbencher of the Year award last year, which I'm very proud of. But the year before, I got an even bigger award, which you might not be aware of, and that was the Daily Mirror's Worst Man in Britain. And that was a much... So, actually, that's a better award for me.
Well, congratulations.
I just thought I'd drop that in there. Maggie, I mean, I was a coal miner. I was brought up in the 1970s, and you probably heard me say this before. We was brought up on a strict political diet of Skinner, Scargill and Tony Benn. That's what you listened to in our house. My dad was a coal miner. All my uncles were coal miners. My granddads, great-granddads, everybody worked down the pit. And all the women worked in the factory. And the pit... when my dad worked out in our village, 3,000 people, all the men in the village worked at the pit, all the women worked in the factory. With the pit came a rugby team, a football team, a cricket team, a sports team, a brass band, a bandstand, a sports and social club, a welfare, a sports ground, rugby pitches, you name it, our village had it. It had all that with one coal mine. That was our community. Now, when the coal mines were taken away from us, when they were closed... Everything went overnight. The sports pitches went, the welfare went, the pubs went, the football, the rugby, the cricket, the tennis, the bowls. Everything went overnight. So whole villages across the Midlands, Notts and the North just stopped talking to each other overnight. And that was the big thing for our communities. You know, we just didn't see each other anymore. And we had to blame somebody. And the person we blamed was Maggie and the Tories. They shut the pits. Labour shut more pits, by the way. But the coal industry was coming to an end. And you got to realise that a lot of our families... had probably been in the pits for 100, 150 years. That was it. It was passed down. It was in your blood. It was in your DNA. I used to sit at the dinner table at night time, listening to my dad telling me stories of his shift down the pit with all these characters that he worked with down the pit, like Taffy and Jock and all these names. And I used to dream of working with these people because they were funny characters. And just a few years later, I was working with these people underground. So it was that what was taken away. It was that sense of community and belonging and an industry which you're born into. If I'd have been born in Sheffield, I'd have probably been a steelworker. If I'd have been born in Liverpool, I'd have been a docker. If I'd have been born in Grimsby, I'd have probably been a fisherman. But I was born in North Notts, and I was a coal miner. It was as simple as that. And that was taken away from us. I understand now why it was taken away from us, because we had a situation where nationalised industries were losing a lot of money. The unions were holding the country to ransom. But you know what? When it affects you directly, you don't always see that. You just think you're being picked on by a nasty Tory government, and that's why we dislike Maggie with a passion. But I'll probably come on to later in this session why I actually forgave Maggie. You can ask me later, or I can tell you now if you want me to.
If you want to, go on.
So obviously we hated Maggie. I joined the Labour Party. I was on the picket line with my dad in 84 in the strikes. And then I went on to work down the coal mines with my dad for many years. And then when I came out of the pits, I did... about 10 years working for Citizens Advice Bureau in Ashfield. I loved that job. That was trying to fix people's problems. But then after that, after working in the homeless hostels for young people, I worked for a Labour MP. I was campaigning in 2017. And this old guy on the marketplace, smoking a fag, and Gloria, who was the MP at the time, Gloria Di Piero, she went to ask him which way he voted. And he wouldn't tell her. He's about 80, I think, and... She came back to me and she said, he won't tell me which way he votes, Lee, but he used to work at the pit. Go and have a word with him. You might be able to get it out of him. So I went to speak to him. And it turned out that at some stage we'd worked at the same pit. So he opened up to me and eventually he admitted to voting Conservative. And I said to him, why do you vote Conservative? Miner for 45 years, live in this area. It's a strong Labour area. Why do you vote Tory? He says, well, in the early 80s, It says I was married, got a couple of kids. My kids went to local comp. He says I worked at the local pit. My missus worked at the factory. And he says I had one of those what's it all about moments. You know, why are we here? Why are we on this earth? What is our function? What is our role in life? He says I'd got hardly any money, working, you know, 5 days a week down a coal mine in a job that I disliked. My missus were doing a hard job. We got, you know, could barely afford to clothe our kids. We lived in a council house. And he just thought to himself, what's it all about? You know, I feel pretty worthless. And, you know, as a human being, to feel worthless. An hard-working man, a coal miner, to feel worthless is incredibly sad to me. It's incredibly sad. He says, and then Maggie came along, and she said to me and thousands of others around the country that you are a decent man, you are a decent family, you're hard-working, you're aspirational, you do the right thing. What I'm going to do for you and thousands of other people is allow you to buy your house at a discount. And he did. He worked 7 days a week. His missus put the overtime in. He saved his house. He saved his money. He got bought his house. He says, and now when I sit on my settee and look out my new patio windows, which I bought myself, he says, I look at my fish pond and my greenhouse and my fence, which I've just creosoted myself, and that's all mine. He says, and when I die and go to heaven, he says, my life would not have been worthless. I've got something to leave to my children and my grandchildren. I thought, my goodness, that's the most powerful story I've ever heard from a human being. One woman had made his life worthwhile. She gave him something. She gave him a hand up, not a hand out. She gave him a stake in society. And that was my road to Damascus moment. And I thought, no other politician ever done that for a working man or woman in this country.
Could you see any circumstances at all in which you'd rejoin the Labour Party or vote Labour again? I mean, the party's changed a lot since it was under Corbyn, hasn't it? Which was when you left.
I mean, it's a ridiculous question.
Thank you.
I mean, have we got any security that can remove this man from the building? Because it is a ridiculous question. I mean, the Labour Party was... I can understand why people like myself was in the Labour Party, because we thought the Labour Party was a party of the working classes, and we weren't. The working classes for the Labour Party, it was... we were useful idiots. We were... You know, I talk about the 70s and 80s a lot. When you joined the pit on a Monday morning, before you did a shift underground, on your very first day, you had to join the union. Mm-hmm. And in them days, it was closed shop unions. It was, if it was the pits, it was the NUM. If it was, you know, the railway industry, it was the National Union of Railway Workers, etc. There was one union for each industry. Mm-hmm. So automatically, when you joined and paid your subs each week, you had a stake in the Labour Party, because a small percentage of those subs went to the Labour Party. So you were part of the Labour Party. You was part of the Labour movement. So it only followed that you would vote Labour when you left school. And when I went to work in the pits, I thought that the coal miners were some rabid left-wing revolutionary force that wanted to strike and, you know, cause revolutions. But they weren't. They were just decent, hard-working men who did an honourable job. And they did it for just a few reasons, really. That were to put food on the table, pay the rent, pay the mortgage, give the kids a good life. All they wanted was a decent hospital, a decent school, and to go to Skegness once you're in a caravan, and that was the lot. And the main thing they wanted was for their kids to do a little bit better than them when they left school, and that's aspiration. That's something that runs through all of us, but it doesn't run through the veins of the Labour Party, and that's why they shut my grammar schools in my area.
When Boris Johnson won the election in 2019 and when the Conservatives won that swathe of Red Wall seats, he was very honest about saying that a load of voters who hadn't voted Conservative perhaps ever had lent the party their votes. Do you think this government has done enough for those people to get those votes again?
That's an interesting question, because when we go out on the doors and around Ashfield, we look at the first-time Tory voters. There's a lot in this country. There's about 5 million. But you say that, I mean, I got 19,788 votes under Boris. The Conservative candidate before me, under Theresa May, got 22,500 votes. So actually, my vote went down, but there's different reasons for that, because we had an strong independent. But you're quite right, there's a lot of people that voted Conservative the first time or are looking for an excuse to vote Conservative next time. It's as simple as that. They're saying, we gave you our vote, we want to vote for you again, but give us a reason to vote for you again. And I think we've seen over the past few weeks where there's a few... it's very hopeful for me over the past few weeks, because we've seen Rishi Roback on the net zero stuff. We've seen Sue Ellis' speech, which I thought was brilliant last week. That was absolutely superb, and I told her so. and people are saying to me, thank God, finally, you know, you're saying to us what we want to hear. Keep this up and you'll get our vote next year. And I think we will. And I think this conference for me has been very positive. The mood is a lot better than what it was last year. There's no doom and gloom here. We're all looking forward to seeing what Suella has to say this afternoon, and then Rishi tomorrow dinner time. And I think if we keep it up, we're down to less than 10 points now in the opinion polls. As soon as it gets to 5 or 6, then we'll see the Labour Party wanting to kill each other. And we'll see the loonies on the left, and we'll see the unions, and we'll see Diane Abbott, who's no longer a Labour MP in Corbyn. They'll start spouting some nonsense, and it's going to be a free-for-all. And we just, you know, keep the ship calm, we'll be fine, and I think we'll win next year.
I mean, you'd...
Come on.
You told the story of the bloke who sort of led to your sort of moment of the road to Damascus.
Yes.
I mean, if you were talking to someone like that now and they said, all right, we've had 10, 12 years of totally stagnant wages, my mortgage or my rent is going up, the prices of everything in the shop's going up, I've got a job that doesn't pay enough to feed my family, where is the incentive there to thank this government?
It's a good question, isn't it?
Bloody good question.
We've took a lot... Yeah, it is a good question. We have took thousands of people out of poverty. There's more people than ever in work in this country. And believe it or not, you know, there's a lot of people in this country who try and diss our great country. And I always say, this country of ours, what we live in, is a gift to the world. It's the best country in the world, and it's still the best country in the world. Everything, well, most things that were great came from this country, whether that's sports... football, cricket, tennis, rugby, whatever, whether it's culture, whether it's the arts, whether it's Shakespeare, whether it's Dickens, whether it's the Industrial Revolution, whether it's medicine, whether it's science, whether it's technology, it all started in this little country and it's carrying on in this country. And literally thousands of people every year risk their lives trying to cross the channel to get to this country, to make that perilous journey from Africa and the Middle East or wherever to get to this country. Now, that tells me that this country is still the greatest country on earth. Everything's not perfect, we know that. You know, wages could be a little bit better. But how do you get wages? How do you make wages better? You get people back to work, you increase opportunities, you increase training, you increase all these things that we're trying to do. You try and sort the benefits system out, which has always been weighted towards people not going to work or working 16 hours a week, living on tax credits, having the wages subsidised. And this goes back to Blair and Brown, the 1997 election, when they made it profitable for people to pack in a full-time job and gone to 16 hours, and that just absolutely stuffed this country up, that did. You know, 20-odd years later, these people who were stuck in a 16-hour-a-week job, thinking it's big and clever to work 16 hours, the kids leave school, they lose the benefits, they lose the tax credits or whatever, and then they're stuck at 50-year-old on an entry-level job, and they say to me, my goodness, I can't afford my rent. And the reason you can't afford your rent, Mr. 50-year-old, is because the Labour Party made it too easy for you to stay at home, and you've not progressed through your career, you've not got that promotion, you're not retrained, and you've suffered and your company's suffered. And it's as simple as that. Blame Blair and Brown.
Just on what you were saying...
They're going to cut every answer, aren't they?
Just on what you were saying about growth, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because, yes, you need to invest in stuff that's going to increase productivity and generate growth. And yet, weren't you saying yesterday or today that it will be fine to cancel HS2 because people were in favour of it? Surely HS2 is precisely the sort of project you need to generate growth and jobs in areas like yours.
Well, I mean, my opinion is I was pretty easy on HS2, whether it went to Ed or not, and I will back government, whatever they do, but... You know, when we stopped the leg going through Ashfield, which I campaigned and spoke to Boris about many, many times, my residents, when that got stopped, they were absolutely delighted, even though there's jobs depend upon it in Ashfield. But what's the point in having a high-speed rail link come through the north of the country or through Ashfield or wherever when I've got pensioners in my villages in Jacksdale and Eastwood and places like that in Ashfield that can't get a bus from one village to the other, 2 miles away, to get a doctor's appointment? What good is it, that little old lady sat looking through her bungalow window at a train going by at 120 mile an hour on a train that she'll never get on, ever, because she never goes to London or Birmingham or Manchester or anywhere. She can't even get from her village to the next village to a doctor's appointment or to see her friend. What a load of nonsense. We need to get our buses sorted and our regional connectivity sorted before we even think about HS2. And I tell you this, HS2 is a gamble, and a bad gambler will always keep throwing money at something.
Let me just try and push you a bit on that. So, I mean, there are on two things. I mean, firstly, from the part of the world that I come from, the original plan was to take HS2 into Yorkshire. The point of HS2 wasn't necessarily to get you from Leeds to London quicker.
I never said that.
No, it was to free up track so that you could get from Bradford to Leeds quicker than you can now, so that you had more efficient local services as well as national.
Is anybody from Bradford in here? Would you want to get there quicker?
You want to get to Leeds quickly.
That'll be on front at Guardian tomorrow, by the way. Nothing wrong with Bradford. We've got great friends there.
Sorry,
Alan. Cheap shot.
Sorry.
No, but, I mean, so it's partly about local connectivity. It's also about growth, isn't it? It's also about generating jobs in places that have... When it's easier to get from Leeds to Manchester, the theory is that the north as a whole will grow, and your lady who's after a bus will see growth around her.
Well, let's make sure that we get local connectivity right. You know, regional railways, it's the buses is the main thing for me. I cannot believe in this day and age that some people are so intent on fitting a high-speed railway the length and breadth of the country, digging everywhere up, kicking people out of their houses. Like I say, I go back to my first point, is that people can't get from one village to another on a bus. If everybody could get to that, you know, from one village to another on a bus, I'd have no argument at all. I'd say, fine, go for it.
All right.
It's about being fair.
Let's just talk about the Conservative Party for a moment. Do you feel comfortable in the Conservative Party? I mean, I'm very old-fashioned when it comes to politics, and I look at you and I listen to you, and you don't look or sound like what I think a Tory should look or sound like, because I have a certain image in my head. Do you... Sorry.
Security,
feel comfortable?
Please. Get him out.
I'm here all week.
One of my questions, I think, was when I went to be a candidate, was what does a Tory look like? And
sound like?
Yeah, what does a Tory, what does a Conservative person look like? So we were brought up thinking they all wore tweed jackets and waistcoats, and, you know, they had a shotgun and went around shooting peasants, not pheasants, peasants, in the morning. We've thought of them sort of people, but they weren't. I mean, most Tories in my area are the sort of Tories that wouldn't admit to voting Tory because they were scared they wouldn't put a poster up at election time because they'd get a brick put through the window. But they're mostly just decent, hard-working people who never thought that the state owed them a living. They thought they, you know, if they had kids, it was their job to feed them. It was, if they wanted more money, it was their job to go out and earn extra money. It was, you know, they took personal responsibility for everything in their lives, and they just wanted a little bit of help, because I'm a big believer that all of us at some stage in our lives will need a little bit of help from our family, our friends or the state, and that's how it should be. But for the most of the time, you should just crack on and get on with it. Stop whinging. You know, we're still a great country. You can do anything you want in this country. Look, 10 years ago, I was sweeping floors in a homeless hostel, and now I'm Deputy Chairman of the Conservative Party and an MP for Ashfield, and I've got a GB news show, and that's in 10 years. So if I can do it, and I'm not the brightest, I tell you, then anybody can do it. True. In from Bradford, still staring at me, by the way.
Yeah. There's a bloke from Sheffield at the back who doesn't like you very much as well, I think, but... You said the Conservative Party is a broad church, but is it a dysfunctionally broad church now? I mean, if you look at the various wings of... I mean, you've got party members, party MPs saying directly contradictory things about basic stuff like the economy, like the size of the state, like, you know, does the party really hold together now? Is it a party that is governable?
I think everybody's got entitled to their own opinions. And look at any political party. We've seen the Lib Dem conference just a few weeks back where the leadership were totally at odds with the membership. I think it's healthy sometimes to have that debate. I'm not convinced it's always healthy to have a public debate about it. I think sometimes people should, you know, I mean, if I criticise government, I do it behind closed doors, and that's the way you do it. I mean, I've been vocal in the past, but, you know, if you want to have a pop at anybody, a minister or the Prime Minister, just knock on the door, because the one great thing about our party in Parliament is I can knock on the Prime Minister's door when we're sitting, and he'll see me pretty much straight away. It's just a text message to his secretary, and you can go and see him, or go and see the Chancellor or the Health Secretary. And that's how it should be done. Like, I understand some people have got a few grievances, but I'm hopeful that we're going to come together. Like I said, this conference has been very positive for me. Lots of members. And let's remember, this conference is about the members and the activists, not about people like me and the MPs and It's about us getting round there and speaking to normal members and normal voters and making them feel special, because they are special. They're the ones that do all the work, and I think sometimes we let them down a little bit. We should remember our place in the world, us MPs should, and we are nothing without the people in this room. Simple as that.
You've in the past, you've complimented Nigel Farage for having the common touch. And I heard Tim Montgomery on the radio this morning saying that if there was a way he could stand as Tory leader, he would probably win. Do you agree?
No.
Why not?
I don't. Because Nigel is probably the most influential politician of the past 30-odd years. And without Nigel, I wouldn't be sat here today. And I am friends with Nigel, and I had a drink with him last night, and I get on with him really well. I think he's a decent man. I think he's done wonders for politics in this country. I think he does a great job for holding our feet to the fire sometimes. He keeps people like me on my toes. But at the end of the day, Nigel stood many, many times for Parliament and he's not won. He won as an MEP under PR, proportional representation. I think Nigel's much more effective doing what he's doing. He's that threat, isn't he? Is that threat of coming back all the time? And I think without Nigel Farage, I mean, my biggest compliment could be for Nigel, is without Nigel, like I said earlier, I wouldn't be sat here today. So thanks, Nigel Farage. I've got a job because of you. I do the best job in the world representing my constituency, which I'm incredibly proud to do. And there's still a place in politics for Nigel. I mean, if he joined the party, I mean, I'd shake his hand and welcome him, but I don't think he will.
He's in the tent next door.
Is he in the tent next door? Yeah. I don't think he will. When you're a character like Farage, he's a larger-than-life character. He's very good at what he does. He's more effective doing what he does rather than being a candidate or a member of Parliament. It's as simple as that. He's great at what he does, and I couldn't give him a better compliment.
OK. Why do you think the Prime Minister made you Deputy Chair?
Probably to shut me up, but...
that worked well.
That went well, didn't it?
I mean, are you sort of... are you his John Prescott, as it were? Is it like the sort of Blair Prescott thing?
I don't like being compared to Prescott, so I thought you were a bit thick, to be honest with you. But I don't know. I guess, fair play to Rishi, because under his leadership, it was the first time ever, and he'd given like somebody from the Red Wall a decent position. And, you know, I'm a first-time Tory voter. The first time I voted Tory was in 2019. And, you know, and lots of my friends and family voted for me who never voted Tory before. So, you know, if you want somebody in the party who's going to connect with the membership and the electorate, I think you should have somebody who's got the T-shirt, who's been that first-time Tory voter, you know, who's been a Labour voter and Labour member all their life and feel let down by the Labour Party. And that person, that only person in the party is me, really, so... and I can say things sometimes, and people say, "Oh, that Lee Anderson says controversial things." I don't think they're controversial, what I'm saying at all. I think it's what you lot are thinking most of the time, it's true. And you know, I have to say these things because I come from a particular background where some of my colleagues have been to Eton and whatever. They can't say some of the things I say because they've not been, you know, they've not been that person living on a little terrace street with a poor mum and dad and. You know, we've got chickens at the bottom of the garden and ducks. But our food bank was my dad's garden. When we'd not got enough food at the end of it, we had to go down and pull some taters out and cabbages and go and neck a chicken, and that was our Sunday dinner. It's as simple as that. We didn't go on TikTok or Facebook or moaning saying, "I've got no food," because my mum and dad's philosophy was simple. They're our kids, we'll feed them. And that's how I was brought up. So when I talk about food poverty in Parliament, and I have done, thank you, and I have spoke about food poverty and the 30p meals and all that sort of stuff. I'm speaking about that from a position of strength. I've been there, I've done it. So, you know, when the Labour Party's lot start, because none of them's done a decent day's work in their life, not one of them's got a dirty hand. So, yeah. So, you know, I've been that man down the coal mine on 12-hour shifts. I've been that man as a single parent who put the last £5 worth of... last £5 in the gas meter and watching the dial go around open, you don't run out. I've been that person, so they can start off.
I mean, just to be clear, there wasn't TikTok when you were a kid. But anyway, leave that to one side. But you talk about your family. Didn't your son kick up a fuss when you joined the Conservatives. Didn't you say your son was unhappy? Is this the veggie son, by the way?
This is the vegetarian.
All right, OK.
Yeah, so he's,
I'd like to apologise for universities the world over, all right?
Yes, he was radicalised at Sheffield University.
That's what we do.
Yeah, and became a vegetarian. That was, but that's a different story. Yeah, I mean, when I... well, the story was, I'd had a few problems with the... I was a Labour councillor, and a few problems. They hated me because the Labour group that run our council was... predominantly Momentum, and this is how crazy they were. They were, when Fidel Castro died, they wanted to open a book of condolence at the local council office. This is true. And I think the word you use for these people is nutters. That's what they are. Absolute nut jobs. And there's one particular council meeting, and one of the Momentum members stood up and went, "Oi, Anderson," there's about 40 people in. And he said, "Anderson, have you ever read the works of Karl Marx?" And I said, "Well, funnily enough, no, I've not." And he said to me, "Why don't you off then and join the Tory party?" This is in 2018, February. Off and join the Tory party. So I stood up, I says, "That's not a bad idea." So I walked out. So I walked out and I joined the Tory party that week. And then 18 months later, I was his MP. True story.
That was a good story.
It's true.
I want to ask you about a few policy areas now. I suppose I've got to start with this. Why do so many Leave voters think Brexit has failed?
That's not true. You're just making that up.
OK. Why do so many people... I mean, more and more people think Brexit isn't working, according to...
According to who? According to who?
According to any survey of public opinion.
I'm not listening to that nonsense. I mean, it is.
All right. So you think Brexit has worked?
Yes, of course it's working. Yeah, we was promised by the Remainers that once we voted to leave, that the sun would stop shining, all the car plants would close down, and this and that. And it's not. You know, it's not. And we are, you know, one of the fastest growing economies now. We're doing pretty well post COVID. So I mean, if I went out and got knocked over today. You know, on this high street here, you bet your bottom dollar a Ramona would say to me, "That's because of Brexit."
Yeah. And are you happy that the government has done all it can to grasp the opportunities of Brexit? I mean, we haven't scrapped the EU laws that the government...
No, I mean, to be fair, we've not had a, you know, to be fair to Boris, he didn't have a fair run at it. We was there for 3 months, I think, when I got elected in 2019. Then we just locked down and we weren't in Parliament for over a year. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to spend over nearly 500 billion quid on rescuing the economy. And we're 2 years behind, I think, on delivering what we promised to deliver. But I think now, I think we're on the right track. It's just that Rishi's only been in post, what, for a year? Nearly a year. And I think he's doing all right. I think he's doing well. He's still the best country in the world. There's plenty of jobs. People's got money. I don't believe all this nonsense about, you know my last stance on the food poverty stuff and the, you know, 350... I had Owen Jones chasing me up here yesterday with a camera. He needs to get a proper job. This poverty nonsense, you know, going the time machine back into when I was growing up in the 70s, that was real poverty. I've got my friend at the back there, Andre. He'll know about poverty in Mansfield when you had notes. And it's nonsense now. It's absolute nonsense. Yeah, things are tough. Things are difficult for families. People's struggling to budget sometimes. But this is not an impoverished island. This is a wealthy country. And the opportunities here are limitless in the UK. If you want something, you can go and get it. But you need to get off your arse and go on and get it for yourself.
Do you think the Prime Minister is doing well on immigration?
The Prime Minister has a plan.
So I've heard.
And we've got the one thing that winds me up, as you probably know, is illegal immigration. And one thing that Rishi gave us, which I wanted from day one, is an Act of Parliament which would mean that people coming here illegally on a boat or in the back of a lorry or whatever... Once they arrived here, they would have no right to claim asylum, and they would be detained and then deported to or sent back to a third country, whether that's their own country or somewhere like Rwanda. He gave us that with the illegal migration bill. Now, we've still got a court case going. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that Rishi gave us that no other Prime Minister has ever given us, so I thank him for that. So he wants to sort it out. The legal migration bit, I think that we should go further. I know sometimes people argue that we need a points-based immigration system to get the brightest and the best. from around the world. Nothing wrong with getting the brightest and the best for, you know, for certain jobs, but I also think that alongside that, the brightest and the best already live in this country, and they always have done, right from time began. So there's a doctor, a solicitor, a lawyer, a brain surgeon, an airline pilot on every single street in our country, and we need to find them. It's our job as politicians and training providers and universities and schools to find these young people. You know, Man United, just up the road, can look at a five-year-old and take them into an academy, and then 20-odd years later, they're playing for England in the World Cup final. Why can't we do that with children? We can if we wanted to. And sometimes it's far too easy to go and get the brightest and the best from other countries. And what does it do to, you know, to other countries, you know, the poorer countries? If you're taking their doctors and nurses and surgeons, you're brain-draining their countries. Them countries really need these people. Not only do they need them, well, they need them to develop. And if we keep taking the best, their development is going to slow down. Meanwhile, we then throw them a 2 million foreign aid. Well, sorry, but keep the foreign aid for ourselves and let them keep the best people.
So would you be in favour of cutting the number of work visas issued immediately then? I mean, the number's now, what, 606,000?
I think my argument always is, whilst ever we've got millions and millions of economically inactive people in this country, and we've got probably 1.5 million people who are on the dole, if you like, whatever that's the situation, we should concentrate on getting them back to work first before we start importing labour. It's as simple as that.
And do you believe in setting targets? I mean, a lot of your colleagues have talked about getting numbers down to the tens of thousands, say. Do you believe in setting that sort of target?
Yeah, I do. I do think we should cap immigration, definitely.
And what would you...
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert on immigration, but I would say, I go back to my previous point, is why ever we've got millions of people not going to work, living on benefits, then we need to concentrate on getting them back to work and contributing towards society before we even think about what the targets are. You know, if we've got shortages of nurses, which we have... You know, why are we importing nurses? Why aren't we making sure that enough people are being trained up, which we're trying to do now with apprenticeship schemes, which is a good thing. But we need to get people back to work in this country. We've got far too many people staying at home or working part-time and getting the wages topped up. You know, if we want to stake in society, we want to live in a fair society, and we've all got to pull our weight. And it's that simple. And stop pandering to this nonsense about, you know, people can't go to work. Go to work. My parents did. I went to work. I think most people in this room go to work. You pull your weight. Everybody should pull their weight. It's as simple as that. Simple as that.
You talked about Suella Braverman's speech last week.
Yes.
In glowing terms. She said that multiculturalism has failed. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. And well, it depends how I look at it, I suppose, because a lot of people interpret this whichever way they want. Now, I think if you're rich, if you come from a decent background, if you've gone to university, if your family are businessmen and you come from an ethnic background, then multiculturalism quite obviously has worked, because you've got plenty of people from different backgrounds in Parliament, in positions, you know, judges, lawyers, solicitors, brain surgeons, whatever. But if you come from the lower end of society where you live on a little Terry Street in Derby or Nottingham where people haven't lived together, where there's people lived on them streets and still can't speak English after 20 years, then multiculturalism has not been a success, because, you know, and us Brits, this is not about foreign people coming here and living in their own little communities and not integrating properly and being multi... And for me, multicultural is when we all live together in harmony and peace and work together and all that sort of stuff. But we see it with the Brits as well. Perfect example is I've got friends who've lived in Spain for 20 years. They live in little communities. They don't live with Spanish people. They live in a community of 100 British families. They send their kids to a British school and they don't even speak Spanish. They've been there 20 years and don't speak a word of Spanish. So it works both ways as well. I think we've got it wrong. You know, when you drip, drip, drip people coming into a country, then you can get people in the country and get people to respect your culture, your history and whatever, and then they become British people. But the way we've done it's been far too quick. And we just lump people into one area, and although you could say it's multicultural because we've got different cultures, but the cultures aren't living side by side together in a way to become British. And I think if you come and live in this country, you should live a British way of life. But, you know, it's okay to retain your own culture. That's perfectly normal, you want to. But you should be British as well, and that's not always happened.
I mean, one thing I would say is that the government has cut the money being spent on providing, say, English lessons and stuff, so it doesn't actually help integration if those sort of cuts are taking place, does it?
Well, I'm not sure whose responsibility it is. I mean, I know people that's come to this country successful people that's come from different countries all around the world. It's just, it's happening now, actually, where they're just chucked into a school at 4 or 5 year old, these children, and then within a year they're speaking perfect English. So I'm not really buying that. I think if you're going to go live in a country, then it's your responsibility to learn the language, not the state's to teach you. I mean, that's just nonsense.
Okay. You said recently that if you're not divisive as a politician, you're not doing your job properly. What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean, all politicians are divisive. Whatever I say today, I mean, I could fly over Manchester today in a jumbo jet and drop 100 billion quid out the window, and I would get reported for fly tipping by the socialists. It's as simple as that. So I guess my message is, whatever political colour you are, you're going to upset half the population. Now, like I said before, I mean, I'm quite divisive. I know I am. Because I try and... I don't know what it is with me, but I try and say everything in a day. I want to get everything off my chest. And if I'm arguing or debating with somebody or the press get me, I think I've got to say what I mean without trying to embarrass my colleagues too much. So I don't want to do that. But you've got to get it off your chest because... Well, now I'm getting it off my chest. I'm getting it off my chest for you people in this room as well, because I'm saying what you want me to say a lot of the time, and you don't say it. So if I can't say it, then you've not got a voice. So I'll carry on being divisive.
Would you agree that there are some problems that are so big and are going to take such a long time to sort that actually we need the two big parties to be able to work together? I mean, social care, for instance, you're not going to fix that in a parliamentary term. And in fact, what you need to do is think about 10, 15, 20 years hence.
I agree with that, with social care, I agree with the NHS, all sorts of things. But, you know, that's a perfect world. We don't live in a perfect world. Politicians and parties. Most politicians, well, a lot of politicians will say, and I've seen this even at local council level and parish council, I'm not in this for the power or the money. I'm sorry, but half of them are in this for the power and the money. That's all they're in it for. There's a lot of good people in Parliament. I've got a lot of brilliant colleagues who've took a massive drop in money to become a Member of Parliament and do it because they want to commit their life to public service. But, you know, to become the governing party, to have that position in number 10, people will say and do anything sometimes to get there. And if that means putting their own self-interest above that of the country, they will do it. And unfortunately, that's the world we live in. That's the real world. You know, people want power. They do, and if they can trample all over another party and the country can suffer a little bit in the meantime, they will do that. Now, I always think a dictator's a good idea, if they're a good dictator, but there's no good dictators, is there, really? I think Jesus might have been one, but there's not. In a perfect world, you'd have a brilliant man who would make all the rules and be fair to everybody, you live in a brilliant society, but we don't. Politics is a dirty business, and people sometimes say, oh, leaders are backstabbers, they've got this job by doing that. Listen, you know, to become the top of your tree in this game, you've got to tread on a few people on the way up there, as long as you do it nicely, because it's a lot at stake. There's a lot at stake, and I look at our Prime Minister now, and Rishi, he doesn't have to be a Prime Minister on 150 grand a year, does he, really? I mean, he gets no sleep, he gets all the abuse, he gets more abuse than me, and that's saying something. And he could just go away somewhere, live on an island, live the life of luxury. And he tell you why he does the job. He does it because he loves this country and he's got a vision for this country and he wants everybody to have nice things and everybody to have a good education, everybody to have a good healthcare system. And fair play to the man. He's sacrificed a nice, peaceful, rich life to come and put up with all this nonsense he puts up with this place and all these idiots we've got outside. So, well done, Richard.
On the subject of money, should MPs have second jobs?
Listen, I know where you're going with this.
Really, I don't.
So I like to think of myself as open and honest. So I get 85 grand a year as a member of Parliament. I think it's 85, 86.
I thought it was 100.
No, it's not.
I thought it was 100.
No, it's not.
All right, I'm disappointed.
Please do your homework before
you... All right, sorry.
It's 86 grand for an MP, and I get 100 grand for doing my GB News. That's not something that's a secret. That's declared on my financial interests. So when people say, you greedy, whatever, I say, listen, you. I say, out of that nearly 200 grand a year, I pay 85 grand a year tax. I pay, to live in this society, I pay 85 grand, and that gives me access to my health service, to police, to fire service, etc. I says, my son, who earns about 22 grand a year, he pays 2 grand a year to live in the same society under the same rules. So I'm paying 40 times more than my own son to live in the same country. Am I mad with him? No. Am I bothered? No. I mean, I earn a good wage. He pays 2 grand, I pay 80 grand. So when people say to me, oh, you've took a second job and earning 100 grand, well, 45 grand of that 100 grand I get will pay for a highly specialised nurse in an ICU unit that might one day save your life.
All right, let me ask that question another way around. I mean, I don't think the issue is whether or not you should be allowed to earn £180,000. I suppose the question is, if people have elected you as an MP, do they have the right to think that you'll do it full-time?
Well, I did do it full-time.
With another job on top?
Yeah. Well, let me come back to you then, because before I did this, 10 years ago, when I worked in the hostels, I had three jobs. I worked in one hostel Monday to Friday on 12-hour nights. Then the weekend, I worked at two other hostels working 14-hour day shifts. Worked that one out, so I've got three jobs. And I tell you what, not one person in politics complained about me having three jobs on minimum wage then, so they can start off.
But, I mean, I suppose the other...
Well, sorry.
Actually, you know what, leave that. Let's just... Because I want to open it up to the audience in a second. I've got to ask you, did you feel uncomfortable about that exchange on GB News between Lawrence Fox and Dan Wooden?
I've not seen it.
Come on.
No, I've not seen it. I was away in Spain. I didn't watch any TV.
Almost tempted to show you it now, but...
Well, I'm not going to watch it. I didn't watch it. I've got no intentions of watching it. I mean,
you haven't heard about it?
I've heard about it, obviously, but I didn't actually watch it on TV because I was on holiday.
But have you heard enough to have an opinion?
Yeah, I think it's wrong what he said.
OK.
Simple as that.
But just one final thing, which is about... I mean, one of the things you see now quite a lot in surveys of public opinion is people have lost faith in politics. So there's an apathy about politics, a distrust of politicians that is quite widespread. Is that something that worries you?
That's a good question. I think the media have got a lot to answer for that.
That's you now.
Yeah. Well, I try and be balanced.
All right.
I think we live in a social media age now where people want instant answers. And with Twitter and Facebook and Instagram or whatever else we use nowadays, people can actually speak to politicians real time. You know, people watch debates in Parliament now and they take an interest in it. And we've got all these news channels like GB News who are giving you your fix of politics real time. And so people are more engaged. People know who the politicians are. People recognise people. I mean, one time a day, you could have an MP in an area and you wouldn't even know who we were. You wouldn't, unless it was one of the high-profile ones. So, yeah, so we're under more scrutiny. And, you know, we get some of the messaging that comes out from parties, and we're probably all guilty of it. And a perfect example is the Environment Act, which we passed. Now, we passed this new act where it was intended to clean up our rivers, our seas and sewers. And it was a wonderful piece of legislation where no government had actually tackled this for donkey's years. So we're sort of making the water companies clean their act up, but somebody put an amendment into the act which basically said that we couldn't use the storm overflows. The storm overflows actually goes to water, the sewage water and the surface water go through the same drain, and it goes through in when we have like heavy downpours of rain, sometimes it has to overflow and go into rivers and seas. That's always happened. It's happened for 100 years. I didn't know that until I became an MP that actually happened. And none of my friends did, but this amendment would have stopped that happening. Now, we could have done that. We could have voted for the amendment and said, yeah, you're going to stop that overnight. But what that meant was that if we'd have stopped that happening, then all the sewage would have just gone into your house and in the streets and backed up. But this naughty amendment that they put in, they then put on every single leaflet and every single graphic that the Tories have voted to dump sewage in our seas, and we hadn't. We'd voted to stop it, but over a period of about 10 years, because you can't do it overnight. And that's why people distrust us, because you've got one party saying that and we're trying to defend it. And it's just wrong. It's nasty, but that's the world we live in. That's why political parties don't work together, because they're always trying to get one up on each other, aren't they?
Yeah. OK, we've got a bit of time left to take questions. Oh, bloody hell.
There's lots of two fingers going on.
OK, because I'm woke and an academic, I'm going to start with a lady. So the lady over there, if so, I don't know where the mic is, actually, so I don't know if that's feasible.
Thank you. Yeah, you spoke about sort of comparing poverty levels today and in the 70s, but do you think that sort of more in the 60s and 70s, parents could choose to sort of one parent could choose to stay at home and look after the children? So do you think that's a fair comparison? Because I think these days families would probably say they couldn't afford to do that anymore.
It's a reasonable question, but no, I think just that, you know, they can afford to do it. I think they can. I mean, my mum and dad, my mother stayed at home for a while until we were at school, I think it was, and they just went without. We come from a background or a culture where the man went to work and the woman looked after children. Now, some people may see that as misogynist and sexist and all this sort of thing these days, but that's just how it was. It was of its time. You know, a man went to work. He did his 6 or 7 days a week in the pit, and the mother stopped at home and looked after the children. And a lot of the time, women wanted to do that. But I think as society evolves and develops, and, you know, women started to work at the end of the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, where people started having more things, buying the house, having holidays abroad, having nice cars. And you sort of get used to that, don't you? You want that. And when you see your parents having that, when you leave school and start your own family, you think, well, I'm having that as well. You don't go back to how it was in the 60s and 70s where one stayed at home. But that comes at a cost. And, you know, and having those things is costly. You've got to put a lot of hours in to get it. But I think sometimes, I always say to my sons, there's no secret to life. If you want nice things, you've got to go to work for them. And if you don't, you're not going to have them. It's no good being jealous of your next-door neighbour or your family member, because you've got to go to work and earn your money for this stuff and save up. And nobody's going to knock on your door and offer you that brilliant job or that nice holiday or that brand-new car. And think, we are very materialistic, but like I say, anything's achievable in this country. And I think it's probably unfair to compare today's living standards sometimes with living standards of yesterday. I know I do it, I'm guilty of doing that, but we're in a different age. People want different things. People want nicer things. People expect things. You know, I go back to my grandma, my great-grandma. She'd had, like, 10 kids. She never left the village she was born in. You know, raising kids, never had no money. What a miserable existence that was. But, you know, would you want that these days? Of course you wouldn't. You'd want a lot more out of life. And so there's no easy answer to that question, but I think it's probably an unfair comparison, just comparing life now to what it was probably in the 70s, although I do it sometimes to suit myself.
Okay, the problem with this, I have no... Where are the microphones? All right, you've got a microphone there. Do you want to... Yeah.
Hi, Lee.
Hi, love.
So just before I came in today, I met my son outside in Starbucks, and when we left, he went off to the junior doctor's strike, and I came in here. And I just wondered what your opinion is on the strikes. When I joined the Navy, my first wage was £371. I think that 30,000 isn't a bad wage, but for a first year, I just wondered what your opinion was.
When you get home, love, ask your son, who's just paid £6 for a cup of coffee, ask him. Oh, you paid for it, did you? OK. Ask him why it's took him 13 years to complain about the wages. As simple as that. It just seems a little bit fishy, don't it? I think, personally, I think the... should be ashamed of themselves. People are dying. I mean, I've had a chap in my constituency, he had a brain tumour, he had to have it removed very, very quickly. But he had to wait for the phone ringing for 2 weeks before he could get a slot because of the strikes. He could have been dead. No, and then doctors and nurses don't go into profession for that. But I'll stick to my point about, you know, they bang on about they've lost 35% of the wages in the last 13 or 14 years. Why didn't they moan about it 13 years ago?
Well, because they hadn't lost it then.
5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, because it's all on the back of these strikes that are going off to try and bring the government down. It's just a constant. It is, it's true. We all have it together.
Oh God, there's... Can we have a microphone somewhere? Actually, I tell you what, do the gentleman standing up there, then we'll move towards the front, if that's OK. Not everyone's going to get their question.
Hi, Lee. How are you doing? My grandma grew up in a working-class rural village down in East Devon, and she's a massive fan of yours, because the argument she always makes is that her parents had no money when she was a child, and they had to budget, and they had to understand how to raise kids on not that much money, and they didn't expect the government just to bail them out. So she loves it, by the way. She's a big fan of yours. She loves it when you make that point. My question to you, and you'll probably agree with this, and I just want to wonder... how you think we can use this to our political advantage. Is the real dividing line in politics today not actually between people that understand how the real world is and people who disagree with them and just call them stupid. How can we call out liberals in big cities who are basically suggesting people like yourselves who have a different view of politics are just too stupid to understand how things are? That's why they gave you that nickname 30p Lee, which I actually think makes you even better, by the way. How can we turn that against them and show ordinary people that actually we're the ones on their side because we never call them stupid? It's only the left that ever call people stupid for disagreeing with them politically.
Yeah. Well done. So look, I'm going to tell you a story about the it's a good one. It's about the 30p Lee. So I was working with a local food bank about 3 years ago in my patch, and we was delivering meals. A mate of mine who's a chef, award-winning chef by the way, he was raising money, buying the ingredients, making these meals at the restaurant he worked at, and then was going out delivering these meals to people in the community who we thought that needed help. And one particular day, I think we was delivering Christmas meals out, and he said to me, this is nonsense what we're doing. What we need to do is help these people to budget and to cook and to learn how to buy the right ingredients, the right cuts of meat. And he says, because I cook cheap at the restaurant, we can help these people with all sorts of skills. And he said to me, I can feed a family of five for 50 quid a week. And I said, you can't do that, that's impossible. He says, I bet you. So we had a bet. So what we did, we got four MPs, me and three other Tory MPs, with the local food bank and local college and children and food bank users. And I went to the Aldi with 50 quid with a shopping list from the chef and a load of school children. And we filled a trolley with 50 quid full of vegetables and meat and all sorts of stuff. And the following day, we went into a big room at the college with all the food bank users there and staff and children, and we had a camera crew, and we made five different meals. The chef taught us how to make these batch cook these five different meals. At the end, we made 172 meals for 50 quid. Now that worked out at 30 pence each for each meal, little tubs, and we put them in tubs, we froze them, then we took them out and delivered them. So when I stood up in Parliament and said, we were batch cooking and making meals for 30 pence each. The point I was trying to make was that if you learn how to get the right ingredients, if you learn how to budget the right cuts of meat, etc., that you can live a lot healthier lifestyle and you save money and you have to buy this junk food and pizzas and Chinese's and McDonald's. And also, if you learn, then you can learn your children how to do it as well, which is a great skill, which I think this skill has been lost over generations. And I made the point that three or four generations now have not kept that skill up, what the parents taught them in the 40s, 50s and 60s, where they could cook from scratch, cook a nice meal. So, of course, the headlines the following day was, Lee Anderson says poor people can't cook. And I never said that. And poor Lee Anderson says, you can feed a family of five on 30 pence. I never said that. But I invited every single Labour MP to come to my food bank. I wrote to every single Labour MP to come to my food bank and take part in this project, because the part of the project was that if you came for a food parcel, You didn't just dole one out. You had to sign up for a budgeting course and a cooking course. So you took your food, but you signed up and you came on the courses. So I invited I wrote to every single Labour MP, said, come and join me at my food bank, and not one single Labour MP responded, because they don't want solutions. They just want to attack you, you know. And it's true. They don't want. They want the Labour Party keep their job through poor people. They keep their jobs by keeping people poor. I want to see people rich. I want to see people have good jobs, have good education, and make their own way in life.
Hang on.
You rightly spoke earlier about Thatcher's legacy with Right to Buy, and that was obviously a huge success. Do you think there's more we can do to make housing more affordable in this country?
Yes, I think there is. Look, the problem we've got, that, I mean, one of the biggest things that fills my inbox is housing. I get one particular group of people saying we're not building enough. My daughter or my family can't get a council house or a house. There's none in the village or the town or wherever. And then I get the next bunch when an application goes in to build 200 houses who are complaining, saying there's too many houses with not enough services and stuff like that. So it's a very difficult one. But we do need houses. And I had this conversation this morning with a colleague of mine about making houses affordable for younger people. Now, back in the day, when we had the sell-off of council houses. Now, back in the day when people bought council houses, these were predominantly people who were working. These were people, mostly a couple, I just got married, would apply for a council house, and you'd probably get one within a month or so. That's how it was in the 50s, 60s and 70s. And these people would work, and like I told the story earlier about the chap who bought his council house, you would buy it at a discount, and that would set you up for life. I said, but to get a council house now or social housing now, if you're a normal, decent, hard-working family, you've got practically no chance of getting a council house or social housing. These will go to what we call priority need, and this was changed years ago in the Homelessness Act, where if you're a priority need, whether it could be a single parent with children, you could have a disability, whatever, nothing wrong with that, then you get priority, which means that the people that were getting council houses 56 years ago are bumped to the bottom of the list and will never, ever get a council house. So they've not got that extra chance, if you like. They've got to go on private rent, and the cost of private renting now are going through the roof. They have in my patch, they've nearly doubled in some place. So the disposable income they've got to actually save for a deposit, that's gone down as well. So they're never going to get a chance to save a deposit unless they move to an area where houses are really cheap. So we've got to do something to help young people get on the housing ladder. I've got my own ideas, but I'm going to save that one for the Chancellor.
You won't share them in advance with us? I mean, what?
No. All right. No, okay. We've just got to help people buy a house, whether that's help them with the deposit and then take the deposit back off them when they sell the house. We've got to help people because they've got very little chance now of getting a council house, saving up and buying that council. They just can't do it.
But it's part of the solution to build more houses.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, we need more houses. We're always going to need more houses. Definitely.
Both of you. We'll go one after the other, then we'll pass it on to that side. Should we take both these and then we can... Yeah.
Hi, Lee. Chloe Chaplin from the I newspaper. You said earlier... Thank you.
I thought you told me no press were coming in.
Well, I didn't tell you anything of the sort.
You said earlier that the government should be prioritising getting the economically inactive back into work, which is something that the government's been trying to do, but clearly it hasn't been that effective. So, in your opinion, what's going wrong? What needs to change in that policy?
I think, I don't know if I want to put it bluntly, I think sometimes we're a little bit too nice. You know, I think, you know, we should be stick and carrot. I think it should be, you know, there should be maybe greater rewards for going back to work. I mean, in some countries, I mean, I've got a friend, Matthew, he's from India. He's been in this country 10 years now. He can't believe the benefit system in this country. He says in his own country, if you don't work, you don't eat. It's as simple as that. Now, I don't want to get to a situation before you quote me on that one, which you probably will. But I think, you know, you can live far too comfortably sometimes in this country without putting a shift in. Now, like I say, when I worked down the pit, I worked 7 days a week. I did that not because I like working underground for 7 days. I did it because I wanted to pay my mortgage and have a run a car and take my kids on holiday and make sure they were clothed well, as simple as that. But for some people, and the benefit system is so... I'll give you an example. About 10 years ago, I was working in a Labour MP's office and a family came in to see me. And it was mum and dad, who'd never worked in their life, and they got five kids, five boys. And I think four or five of them was on DLA for ADHD, which is behavioural problems. And I worked their benefits out because they're on ADHD. Even now, if you're on a disability benefit, you're exempt from the benefit cap. We sat down and worked the benefits out, and they was with their rent, with their council tax, with their child tax credits, with the disability premium, severe disability premium on the tax credits, they were getting a net of £52,000 a year, and this is like 2012. And I'm thinking to myself, and that to get that, you would need to probably earn 75 grand a year to get 52 grand. And these people are coming in saying, can we get any more money? I'm thinking, my goodness, I'd like half of that, to be honest with you. And I sat there and I worked it out and I thought, there's five of us in this office all paying tax and national insurance, and that's not covering that 52 grand for that one family. Now, the fact also, they've got these children on ADHD. I don't believe a lot of that. I think some of it's just bad parenting, where they're nuisances, basically. But then poor children are then going to grow up at 18 and think, well, I'm disabled, I can't work. And we've not broke the cycle. We've actually passed one set of problems on to the next set of problems. And I think sometimes we've got to be a little bit braver and say to them young people, you're not disabled, you can go to work, we're going to help you, we're going to support you. But why have we got a system in place which encourages parents to sometimes, not all parents obviously, but encourages certain parents to make extra money by labelling their kids as disabled, then we're going to have a problem. We need to get people into work. Look, these kids, They've never heard an alarm clock go off in the morning. They've never heard mum and dad sit around the table at night time and talk about their day at work. So what chance have they got? You know, they say to me, how can you get that 16-year-old little Johnny to work when his mum and dad has never gone to work? That's a difficult thing to do because they've never heard that in the house. They've never heard dad get up in the morning, never heard mum get up. They've never heard the conversations at the dinner table. They've never heard stories about the day at work. So when you're saying to 16-year-olds, you've got to go to work, and you think, well, my mum and dad's never gone to work in the life, why should I go to work? We've got a roof over our head. That's a very difficult conversation to have, and it's very difficult to get out of. And somebody's got to suffer for that, and at the moment, it's a taxpayer that's suffering for it.
Hello. Oh, there we are. Sadly, I'm also a journalist, Lee. Adam Payne from Politics Home. You said how much you liked the Home Secretary's speech last week, how much looking forward to her speech that's happening soon. There are some MPs in your party who aren't in quite the same place as you on that. They think she's toxifying the party brand and would probably prefer it if the PM were to replace her. Why are they wrong on that?
Which MPs are that?
The sort of One Nation crowd.
No, which MP in particular?
Well, there's a number of them who usually do it.
Which MP? Yeah, which MP is it?
Well, I'm obviously not going to reveal.
Name them.
I'm not going to reveal sources.
So you're making it up?
That's... No.
Go on. Name them.
Are you honestly saying that all MPs absolutely agree?
Well, name them.
You're saying that...
Name them.
Lee, as a journalist yourself, you know that MPs don't often speak with their names to quotes.
Well, so you're just making it up. So if you get a call in the middle of the night saying, I'm an MP and I don't like Suella, you're going to print that, are you? I mean, what training school did you go to?
No, but you could... But hang on, you can have a coffee with an MP who says, can you... Don't use my name.
Well, then...
It doesn't have to be down the phone, does it?
Then you've got no proof at all, have you?
Name them.
Name them. Are we done? It's half past.
That lady there has had a hand up for ages and then we're done. I know we're about to run out of time.
Thank you. I'm Deborah Taylor, Deputy Leader at Leicestershire County Council. We're the lowest funded county council in the country and 85% of our budget is spent on supporting vulnerable people, adult social care, child social care. We've had our fairer funding going for absolutely years now with no response. So what's your view on the fairer funding review?
You leave the toughest question to last, don't you? Which council is it?
5 seconds to answer it.
Leicestershire County Council. Come and see me after.
Good answer. On that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop because Conservative Home have got this ruthless schedule. Can I thank, firstly, Conservative Home? Can I thank, secondly, actually, Steve Bray for not being outside playing Benny Hill as he was last year? And finally, can I thank Lee Anderson for what was an interesting session? Thanks ever so much.